KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Some Iranians have been trying to flee their capital city. Cars are lined up at gas stations, roads are jammed, and the sky is frequently lit up with missile strikes. Where is the war with Israel going next? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. What drove a Minnesota man to allegedly shoot several Democrats and gather names of more? I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. His background includes time at a theological institute. The group has stark views of abortion, though it says violence is not what we teach. 10 years ago, Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote a book about the pressures black people face. What does he think has changed in a decade? It's Tuesday, June 17th. This day in 1930, President Herbert Hoover signed the Smoot-Hawley Act, which raised tariffs and launched a trade war that deepened the Great Depression. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. A federal appeals court will hear arguments today on President Trump's decision to send National Guard troops to Los Angeles in response to immigration protests. From member station KQED, Marisa Lagos reports.
Last week, U.S. District Judge Charles Breyer sided with California, ruling that the president acted illegally when he activated 4,000 National Guard troops without consulting Governor Gavin Newsom. Breyer ordered Trump to return control of the Guard to the governor. But within hours of that decision, a three-judge panel from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals blocked Breyer's ruling and scheduled today's noon hearing. The appeals court panel includes two Trump appointees and one judge appointed by former President Joe Biden. They'll consider whether the temporary restraining order was warranted. For NPR News, I'm Marisa Lagos in San Francisco.
The NAACP is not inviting President Trump to its national convention next month. He's the first sitting U.S. president not to ask to attend in the civil rights organization's 116-year history. NPR's Kristen Wright reports the White House is responding to the snub.
In a statement, a White House spokesman criticizes the NAACP as advancing hate and division, while President Trump is focused on, quote, uniting our country and improving our economy. The spokesman also says that's the vision supported by many black Americans in Trump's reelection. The NAACP's president says Trump's not invited because he's, quote, attacking our democracy and civil rights and signed unconstitutional executive orders to oppress voters and undo federal civil rights protections. The group has welcomed both Democratic and Republican presidents to speak at its annual convention. President Ronald Reagan addressed members. So did President George W. Bush in the wake of Hurricane Katrina after declining previous invitations. Trump declined the NAACP's invitations to speak during his first term. Kristen Wright, NPR News, Washington.
Legal experts say a federal bankruptcy court is likely to approve a new $7.4 billion opioid settlement with Purdue Pharma and members of the Sackler family. But NPR's Brian Mann reports some critics say the deal does not offer enough compensation to opioid victims.
All 50 states and U.S. territories have now signed off on a deal that would direct most of the payout to governments for spending on addiction treatment and health programs. Only about $850 million will go to people addicted to Purdue Pharma's OxyContin pain medications or to families who lost loved ones to overdose. Ryan Hampton, who is addicted to OxyContin for more than a decade, says he'll only receive about $3,500.
And for $3,500 to be a paycheck to absolve Purdue's role in destroying my life is a meaningless gesture. But at this point, I'm ready to put this behind me.
Parties negotiating final details of the settlement will be back in federal bankruptcy court this week. Brian Mann, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down more than 95 points at this hour. You're listening to NPR. For the next 2 weeks, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration is hearing public comment about heat. OSHA proposed a rule to protect workers from heat last year, but NPR's Alejandra Barunda reports the rule's future is uncertain.
The first time someone suggested OSHA make a rule protecting workers from heat was about 50 years ago. But as climate change makes heat more dangerous, the agency took note. In 2021, it started working on a rule. Juanita Constable is a heat policy expert at the Natural Resources Defense Council.
The rule would provide basic protections for workers that they should be getting anyways: water, rest, shade, training, emergency response procedures.
The rule has garnered opposition from industries like construction and support from workers' rights groups. Whether it will move forward after the public comment is uncertain. President Trump has said he aims to remove 10 regulations for every new one implemented. Alejandra Borunda, NPR News.
The College World Series has its first no-hitter in 65 years. And as NPR's Giles Snyder reports, it's only the third in the tournament's history.
Arkansas pitcher Gage Wood is now part of an exclusive group. He is only the third pitcher to throw a no-hitter in CWS history. The others are Oklahoma State's Jim Wixon in 1960 and Texas's Jim Ehrler in 1950. Wood threw 119 pitches in the game against Murray State, 83 of them for strikes in a 3-0 elimination game victory.
NPR's Giles Snyder prepared that report. Again on Wall Street, the Dow was down nearly 100 points. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include AG1, introducing AG1 Next Gen, a daily drink with vitamins, minerals, and probiotics to support overall health. Learn more at drinkag1.com/science.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Coming up, Los Angeles Dodgers superstar Shohei Ohtani took the mound for the first time in nearly 2 years last night. But first, President Trump left a G7 summit in Canada a day ahead of schedule.
The president said it was to focus on the rapidly escalating conflict between Israel and Iran. He also posted a warning on his social media platform Truth Social, telling Iranians to immediately evacuate their capital.
For more, we're joined by NPR's Adil Alshalchi in Tel Aviv. So considering President Trump's warning, what's the mood like in Tehran right now?
Well, we know that people are very anxious. There is an atmosphere of panic and confusion in Tehran today. People are stocking up on food. Tehran's streets are quiet, especially at night, which is when Israel carries out most of its strikes. NPR reached out to a woman named Baran in Tehran. She asked us to only use her first name because the situation is so sensitive in Iran right now. She said she and her family tried to leave Tehran yesterday, but had to turn around. You can hear the fear in her voice. She says they couldn't fill up their tank. All gas stations had lines a couple miles long, and people were waiting up to 4 hours for fuel. The roads out of the city are also bumper-to-bumper traffic, so leaving, evacuating Tehran is no easy feat right now.
Now, Israel's ambassador to the UN told us last week that preemptive strikes were meant to prevent Iran from putting together a nuclear weapon. So 5 days in, how has Israel's messaging and actual targets changed?
I mean, you're right. So almost immediately after the start of the attack on Friday morning, Israel struck military targets, killing top security officials like the chief of staff of Iran's army. It also struck three nuclear facilities, including the main one called Natanz. But now Israel is expanding its attacks. For example, yesterday, the Israeli military attacked the studio complex of Iran's state news channel. You know, there's a video online of the moment this happened. You hear the anchor speak and then the explosion. You You know, in the video, you see the anchor flee the studio and pieces of the roof start to fall on top of her head. Israel's defense minister confirmed the attack, saying, quote, "We will strike the Iranian dictator everywhere." So now the question is the political apparatus fair game now? Will Israel go for Iran's supreme leader next, for example?
Yeah, so if Israel does that, I mean, does this mean this war changes from nuclear capabilities to regime change?
So the Israeli military has said that it's been instructed to dismantle Iran's nuclear capabilities, not specifically for regime change. But in an interview on ABC yesterday, correspondent Jonathan Carl asks Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu this question.
So are you going to target the supreme leader?
Look, we're doing what we need to do. I'm not going to get into the details.
So, you know, Netanyahu hasn't ruled it out.
All right. So where does this put the United States now?
So far, the U.S. has only helped with defending Israel with the interception of missiles. Trump has, always said that he doesn't want Iran to have a nuclear weapon. He says he has, but a preference is to do this via a deal. He said that maybe Israel's war may force Iran to make a deal. But now, you know, Iran pulled out of the talks. So now, as the war intensifies, all eyes may be on whether or not Trump changes course and decides to directly get involved in the war.
NPR's Hadil Alshalchi in Tel Aviv. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Our next guest is Karim Sajidpour. He's a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He specializes in Iran. He's given us advice for many years, and he's back once again. Karim, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, Hadil just now mentioned expanding target lists. We started with nuclear and military facilities that Israel was targeting, but then oil facilities and now state TV. What have you thought about as the Israeli target list seems to get bigger?
Well, since its inception in 1979, the Islamic Republic of Iran has spent decades seeking to eradicate Israel, and it now seems to be that Israel is pursuing the same goal, trying to eradicate the Islamic Republic. Their targets have expanded. They've established aerial dominance in Iranian skies, and it doesn't seem that Prime Minister Netanyahu is intent on ending these military operations anytime soon.
You make a helpful point in that while Israel conducted a preemptive attack here, a preventive attack, as they would put it, it's almost as if these two countries have been at war for almost half a century.
That's true, and it's unfortunate because in contrast to most modern geopolitical conflicts like between Russia and Ukraine or Israel and the Palestinians, this isn't, in my view, a geopolitical conflict. There's no direct land or border disputes between Iran and Israel. Persians and Jews, and it'll go back thousands of years. This is really an ideological battle, and it's, in my view, a war of choice for the Islamic Republic of Iran. Prior to the 1979 revolution, Iran and Israel had cordial relations. So in my view, this antipathy toward Israel, the official slogan of death to Israel from 1979 onward, is not a reflection of the national interests of Iran.
Okay, so it was a war of choice by Iran to target Israel. Now, in the more recent frame, it is an attack of choice or an offensive of choice by Israel to go after Iran in this bigger and bigger way. You said that it raises the question as to whether Israel is seeking regime change in Iran. What has President Trump said over time about that possible goal?
Well, that's an interesting question, because as recently as 30 days ago in President Trump's speech in Riyadh, he lambasted those who have sought regime change in the Middle East, interventionists and nation builders, who he said have destroyed far more nations than they've built and had no ideas about the realities of the societies in which they were intervening. And, you know, early in President Trump's term, the fear that the Israelis had was that he was too aggressively seeking a deal with Iran, seeking diplomacy with Iran. And now the fear that a lot of Trump's MAGA base have is that he's getting sucked into another Middle East war that they've long feared.
Well, I want to talk about the realism of regime change, what's possible and what's not. Hadil mentioned that a large number of military leaders have been killed. People are asking if political leaders might be targeted next. Israel certainly seems to have a lot of capabilities. But then the question is, does Iran have a bench? Can they elevate new leaders? Is their system set up to be durable and produce new leaders as well as maintain political support?
Well, this is a large country, right? 90 million people. It's a regime which has been in power for 46 years. It's true they have an old supreme leader, 86 years old, and there's a lot of talk about succession to him. But the bottom line is that despite the regime's unpopularity, and I suspect they only have about 15 to 20% popular support, the idea that that the Iranian society can organize a protest movement while they're under aerial bombardment is just highly unlikely. As Hadil alluded to, people are incredibly anxious and they're thinking about their daily safety and security. And so I think that Israel can effectively eliminate Iran's top military and perhaps even political leaders, but that's not doesn't seem to be a strategy to transition into a different type of a regime.
Is a collapse, as we saw in Syria last year, just not very likely here?
Anything is possible, Steve. You know, even up until a week before the collapse of the Assad regime in Syria, U.S. government officials were talking about engaging Assad, so they didn't see that coming. But in this context, it's tough to see a regime imploding while it's fighting for its life, and it believes that it either needs to kill or be killed.
And as you point out, there's not a viable resistance movement as there was in Syria, at least not something that we can see publicly. Karim, thanks so much for your insights, as always.
Thank you, Steve.
Karim Sajidpour is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C.
In Los Angeles, Dodgers superstar Shohei Ohtani returned to the pitcher's mound last night for the first time since undergoing elbow surgery in 2023. Now, what makes Ohtani unique is the fact that he's an all-star hitter and an all-star pitcher, but he had never pitched for the Dodgers, the team he joined last season after signing a $700 million contract. Steve Futterman was at Dodger Stadium last night.
There was no doubt who the center of attention was last night.
On the mound for the Dodgers, number 17.
For the first time as a Dodger, Shohei Ohtani was introduced as a pitcher. That's what fans like Thomas Craig came to see.
It's exciting. It feels like history. Just come off a World Series, and now Shohei Ohtani's pitching for the first time since 2023.
In one inning against the San Diego Padres, Ohtani threw 28 pitches. One pitch was clocked at 99.9 miles an hour. Another reached 100.2. Ohtani showed a bit of rustiness. He allowed two hits and one run. After the game, he said through an interpreter, it was a decent start.
Not quite happy with the results overall, but I think the biggest takeaway for me is that I feel, you know, good enough to be able to make the next outing.
San Diego star third baseman Manny Machado was impressed with Ohtani's stuff, especially considering his lengthy pitching layoff.
You know, it's just a small sample size, and, you know, looking forward to, definitely facing him down the road.
He's going to be okay.
Come on now. He's going to be fine.
As simply a hitter, Ohtani is one of baseball's best. When you add his pitching to the equation, his value is off the charts. L.A. manager Dave Roberts was happy last night.
I thought the stuff was really good. I thought he made some really competitive pitches. Overall, just really positive day for us.
The Dodgers hope to slowly increase Ohtani's workload. They expect his next pitching appearance to come in around a week. He may go two innings. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman at Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Larry Charles. He's contributed to TV shows and films that both reflect and have had an impact on pop culture in America, serving as a writer, director, and executive producer on shows like Seinfeld, Mad About You, Entourage, and Curb Your Enthusiasm, and directing films like Borat and Bruno. He joins us to talk about his new memoir. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Dickinson College, awarding the Rose Walters Prize for Global Environmental Activism to combat climate change and inspire future leaders. Learn more at dickinson.edu/RWP. From Progressive, with small business insurance for protecting a variety of business types with multiple coverage options, designed to fit business owners' needs. More about small business insurance is at progressivecommercial.com. From Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at viking.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. 10 years ago, Ta-Nehisi Coates published the book Between the World and Me. The memoir, written as a letter to his then 15-year-old son, was a literary phenomenon. 10 years later, as Ta-Nehisi points out in his latest book, The Message, nearly half the country's school children are under state orders to be protected from, quote, critical race theory and other, quote, unquote, divisive concepts. Between the World and Me is now out in paperback on the 10th anniversary of its publication, so we thought this would be a good time to check back in with Ta-Nehisi Coates, and he's with us now. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Michelle. It's good to talk to you again.
You know, we actually spoke 10 years ago about this book. And
did
we really? Yes, we did.
Oh my God. Wow.
We actually have the tape of my talking to you 10 years ago. I think we'll drop it in.
Oh, please play a little bit of it. Oh God, that'll be great.
Sure. Let's hear it. Why not? Okay.
Yeah.
Do you feel that there is now some pressure to be kind of an oracle of race in a way that you did not feel before? Do you want that job?
No. And I've been, you know, very, very careful to tell people what I'm qualified to talk about and what I'm not qualified to talk about. And no one person should be, you know, the spokesperson, you know, for that experience. No one person should be the oracle, be the articulator.
Yeah, I still agree with that. I haven't changed on that.
All right.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
And so I know that this is kind of a crazy, unknowable question. Is this what you hoped would happen as a result of this book?
Well, that's a great question. And it's a great question because I'm conflicted. Yes, to some extent. I wanted to be well-read like any writer wants to be well-read. I wanted to be well-respected as a writer like any writer wants to be well-respected. I remain somewhat flummoxed at the notion of writers as a kind of oracular presence, or the idea that because you wrote a book or two or three that, you know, people really enjoy, that means you have some sort of greater thing to say beyond what's actually in the book. Hmm. So like when I think about Between the World and Me, for me, the most riveting part of that book was, you know, not so much what I had to say, but what Dr. Mabel Jones, Prince Jones's mother, had to say, you know?
Hmm. So let me go back to that, back to why you wrote Between the World and Me. You dedicated your National Book Award and the book to a young man named Prince Jones, whom you knew at Howard University.
Yeah.
Would you just say what happened to him and why it imprinted itself on you so strongly?
Well, Prince was killed by a Prince George's County police officer undercover. And that officer followed my friend Prince from Prince George's County through the District of Columbia into Virginia, where he shot him, you know, a short distance away from the home of the mother of his child and you know, where he was going to see his young child. And it imprinted on me because I watched the dialogue about it in the days afterwards, where they speculated, was he a drug dealer? Was he this? Was he that? And Prince was like a, you know, a born again Christian. He was the exact opposite of everything. You know, like this model of who you want, you know, your son to be, you know, publicly, you know, presenting that I think Black parents often fashion. He was like the walking example of it. You know, he was well-spoken. Yes, sir. No, sir. You know, it's kind of Southern, you know, yes, ma'am. No, ma'am thing he would have, very gentlemanly. I mean, at Howard, he pledged gentleman of Drew, and like he got killed by a police officer. I mean, it was just the most, and I spent 15 years weighing how that happened and like why the dialogue around him was so different than the person that I knew. And that was the seed of Between the World and Me all those years before.
Why do you think Between the World and Me had the impact that it did? Do you have a sense 10 years later of what it captured in the moment that captured the public attention?
I think there are things that are in your control and things that are not in your control. The thing that was in my control, I should say our control, because I'm about to talk about my wonderful editor, Chris Jackson, was to, like, we had this test, and the test was, could a 14-year-old kid who liked reading read the book? And then the thing that is outside of your control, and that is just where the country is or where the audience is at that particular moment. The Mother Emanuel massacre had happened that summer. Mm-hmm. And actually the book was not supposed to come out until, I think, end of September, August. And they moved it up after the massacre, because I think people were just searching, you know, for answers as to like how this, you know, had happened. Mm.
So let me now quote from your latest book, The Message, which has also caused quite a stir. It may seem strange that a fight that began in the streets has now moved to the library, that a counter-revolution in defense of brutal policing has now transformed itself into a war over scholarship and art. But in the months after George Floyd's murder, books by Black authors on race and racism shot to the top of the bestseller list and most borrowed lists. Black bookstores saw their sales skyrocket. The cause for the spike was, in the main, people who had been exposed to the image of George Floyd being murdered, who suddenly began to suspect that they had not been taught the entire truth about justice, history, policing, racism, and any number of other related subjects. You know, here your book was so celebrated 10 years ago, and then 10 years later, people are trying to ban it or at least make it harder to access. And I just wonder what you make of that.
Probably go hand in hand. I mean, one of the things that, I went and researched this when I was working on The Message. It's like, you know, Toni Morrison faced bans for like the vast majority of her literary career. Certainly, you know, the greatest novelist of the latter half of the 20th, early 21st century, you know, people put her, you know, in that sort of ranks. And yet she consistently faced bans in a way that I would point out, other writers who might contend for that same title did not in the same degree that she did.
So what kind of conversations are you having, or do you have a sense of what kinds of conversations you're going to have now? Or the lack of conversation a statement in itself?
About Between the World and Me?
Yeah, about Between the World and Me.
You know, it's hard to talk about it. I mean, even now, like, it's weird to talk about the book, because it's like, I feel like, again, you know, I talk about this in The Message about how, you know, these books are like kids and they go on and they have their lives. It's like, I really, really believe that once you publish the book, it really doesn't belong to you anymore. It's not yours, you know?
Ta-Nehisi Coates is the author of Between the World and Me, which is celebrating a decade in print, and it's available in paperback now. Ta-Nehisi Coates, thanks so much for talking to us once again.
Thank you, Michelle.
This is NPR News.
It's been 30 years since Cece Winans released her debut album, Alone in His Presence, now a classic in contemporary gospel music.
When I get to go back and visit my younger self, I can just nod my head and say, yep, his presence is definitely my hiding place.
I'm Juana Summers. Cece Winans stops by to celebrate Black Music Month on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Israeli military says it has killed another top Iranian military official since its strike against the Islamic Republic erupted in a conflict that's quickly escalated since Friday. Meanwhile, President Trump's back in Washington, D.C. Yesterday, he suggested a nuclear deal with Iran was achievable. Today, he urged Tehran's residents to evacuate ahead of more Israeli strikes. After he got back to D.C. from the G7 summit in Canada, Trump told reporters on the tarmac Iran should not be allowed to have a nuclear program.
I hope their program's going to be wiped out long before that, but they're not going to have a nuclear weapon.
Trump also dismissed the assessment of U.S. spy agencies that before the conflict, Iran was not building a nuclear weapon. Today, the director of national intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, scheduled to testify before Congress. This week, members of Congress are expected to attend emergency briefings about their security following the Saturday attacks in Minnesota that killed one state lawmaker and injured another. The accused shooter's targets allegedly extended to elected officials beyond Minnesota. Michigan Congresswoman Debbie Dingell shared the latest at a town hall in Dexter yesterday.
They called and said the FBI had that my name had been on the list.
Like the state lawmakers from Minnesota, Dingell is also a Democrat. At last check on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 100 points at 42,414. It's NPR News. The California press advocacy group, the LA Press Club, is suing the city of Los Angeles and the LA police chief over how journalists were allegedly treated as they were covering the recent mass protests against federal immigration enforcement. NPR's David Folkenflik reports.
Being a journalist in Los Angeles is now a dangerous profession. That's how the lawsuit filed by the LA Press Club and the investigative site Status Quo started. Many of the incidents were captured on video, some of them streaming or beaming live at the time. Police firing so-called less lethal bullets tipped with rubber at relatively close range toward journalists. Police detaining reporters with their hands behind their backs and leading them away, or firing tear gas canisters and flash grenades toward them. The suit alleges violation of the U.S. and California constitutions, along with recently strengthened state laws protecting press rights. City and LAPD officials have not yet responded to the suit. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
MyPillow founder Mike Lindell says he plans to challenge a court order to pay damages to a man he accused of treason. Eric Coomer used to work for Dominion Voting Systems. That's a company publicly targeted by pro-Trump election deniers such as Lindell, who claimed the 2020 election was rigged. Yesterday, a jury found Lindell guilty of defamation and ordered him and his online media platform to pay Coomer $2.3 million in damages. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG. Our purpose is people. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Me, Martinez, in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. This is the moment in an investigation when authorities seek a deeper answer as to why. Why a person took beliefs that many people have and converted them into violence. Prosecutors say the man charged with killing a Minnesota lawmaker and her husband had a notebook with other targets, most or all Democrats. The acting U.S. attorney says abortion rights supporters were among those targets, and that calls attention to a radical anti-abortion ideology. NPR domestic extremism correspondent Odette Youssef joins us. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so what do you know about this man's background that seems like it may be relevant here?
Well, one aspect that's getting a lot of attention, Steve, is the religious context that he comes from. I spoke with Fred Clarkson from Political Research Associates about this, And he has homed in on a couple aspects of Vance Belter's background. One is that he graduated from a theological institution called the Christ for Nations Institute, which is the precursor to something called the New Apostolic Reformation. Belter did missionary work in the Democratic Republic of the Congo as well. And videos of him sermonizing there show him saying that there will be prophets and apostles in the U.S., which, again, is distinct to NAR theology.
Okay, so he went to this earlier version of this theological institute that is now known as New Apostolic Reformation. What more can you say about it?
Well, it's a decentralized network of churches and religious leaders who used to really be on the fringe of the conservative Christian right. But today, prominent figures in the network are closely tied with House Speaker Mike Johnson. They've been featured in prayer events he's organized. This is a neo-charismatic expression of Christianity, Steve, and it's distinct in the sense that it embraces ideas such as modern-day prophets and apostles. It also espouses what's called dominionist thinking, where they believe it's important to take control over every aspect of society to impose Old Testament biblical governance. So Clarkson says it is definitionally an anti-democratic venture.
It's just understood that it's going to involve physical warfare.
And the Christ for the Nations Institute issued a statement saying the school is, quote, aghast and horrified that a CFNI alumnus is the suspect, and, quote, this is not who we are, this is not what we teach.
And I guess we should emphasize, individuals do things for their own individual reasons, and it's hard to say at this point exactly why the suspect acted this way, but what does this connection to this NAR group mean when it comes to the suspect's views on abortion rights?
Well, this movement considers abortion to be an abomination. But as you said, the question is, how have we come to the point that this is expressed by killing people instead of debating policy? I spoke with Carol Mason at the University of Kentucky. She says over the last several decades, rhetoric about abortion on the right has morphed into a radicalized ideology.
Abortion used to be seen as a sin, like adultery or blasphemy. But over time, it became not just a sin, it became evil, until people were convinced that abortion is not simply a matter of terminating a pregnancy, but is actually a full-scale genocidal industry meant to serve an evil, satanic, global cabal whose mission it is to wipe out Christian civilization.
And what's additionally worrying here, Steve, is that we're in a post-Roe era. You know, we heard from opponents of Roe, including President Trump, that overturning Roe was really about letting states decide abortion policies for themselves. But in fact, there's been an increase in abortion-related violence in states that continue to protect access.
NPR domestic extremism correspondent Odette Youssef, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hurricane season is underway, but many people in western North Carolina are still struggling to recover from last year. In the town of Swannanoa, flooding from Hurricane Helene destroyed homes and businesses, including the only supermarket there. NPR's Greg Allen reports that nearly 9 months later, residents say they still have few options for fresh food.
U.S. Highway 70 is the main road in Swannanoa, and it's still a mess. There are piles of debris and buildings without windows and roofs. Most of the businesses that line the highway are still closed. Many may never reopen. But on a side street in a church parking lot, about two dozen people holding grocery bags are lined up. They come here every week to pick up free food distributed by a local nonprofit, Bounty and Soul.
I've got some yellow squash, apples, garlic, potatoes, kale, tomatoes, lemons.
Shelley Dickerson lives in Swannanoa with her husband and daughter. Because there's no grocery store, she especially values the fresh produce.
Today was a little exceptional. We got extra veggies, fruit. We got some grapes. And they usually always have some type of bread.
Do you have some sour bread today?
Hey. This is all we've got left is a lot of these rolls.
Volunteers and employees with Bounty and Soul staff a truck that takes produce and other fresh food to communities like this one, where months after the storm, it can be hard to find.
Swannanoa is a food desert.
Paula Sellers helps run Bounty and Soul, a group that buys produce, much of it from local farms, and distributes it to communities where it's needed. After Helene hit the area last September, they began coming to Swannanoa.
Fresh food in this little Swannanoa region is very difficult to come by. The Ingalls grocery store that is located in Swannanoa did get flooded out. They had major impacts, and it's unclear if or when they are going to restore that store to functionality.
The Ingalls grocery store chain tells NPR that it's working on plans, but still has no timeline for when or if it will reopen the store. Sellers says Bounty and Soul will be in Swannanoa for as long as it's needed.
Prior to the storm, 1 in 6 adults and 1 in 5 children in Western North Carolina was food insecure.
And now she says it's worse. Many here still don't have homes, vehicles, and jobs. A small local bakery, Blunt Pretzel, is still serving free daily meals to residents. Christopher Smith lives nearby, and with his wife stumbled onto Blunt Pretzel as they were looking for water after the storm.
And I looked down the hill, and here was Blunt Pretzel's smoke billowing off the grills, and I smelled pretzels in the air, and I saw a line of people that were just kind of like, oh my goodness, there's food and water here.
Smith started as a volunteer and soon found himself working alongside staff from World Central Kitchen preparing meals for the community. World Central Kitchen eventually left, but it gave Blunt Pretzel a blueprint on how to add a nonprofit, Blunt Kitchen. Smith says people still need to be fed.
These people, many of them are displaced because their home was either flooded, inundated, or washed into the river completely. Maybe their employer was washed into the river or cannot sustain because they don't have enough business, so they're underemployed or unemployed and just need one or two meals so they can pay their light bill. So there's different angles to look at how feeding somebody could be helpful.
The rest of the country may have moved on from last year's hurricane season, but in Western North Carolina, and especially in Swannanoa, the lines of people getting food are an indication recovery from Helene still has a long way to go. With producer Marisa Pinalosa, I'm Greg Allen, NPR News, Swannanoa, North Carolina.
This is NPR News.
Ten years ago this week, a white supremacist shot and killed 9 worshipers at a church in Charleston, South Carolina. Charleston's first poet laureate looks back on the tragedy next time on Here and Now.
Your city, your station, your news. Download the NPR app today, your new home for live radio, local podcasts, and everything you love from NPR.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep with a bid to spread understanding across generations. A college in Scotland last year offered a class on Taylor Swift to help older people understand why young people are obsessed. Now that college is a class on Oasis to help younger people understand their parents. The group plans a reunion tour, so Oasis superfans who teach at the college set up the class. One lecturer has seen Oasis 20 times, has Oasis tattoos, and named her son after a band member. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, for nearly a century supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at mott.org. From the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Spam is not just email. Turns out the junk messages for an older technology seem to be on the rise. Vito Emanuel has this story.
You probably haven't heard this sound in a long time, if ever. But Diane Rosa hears it every day.
We are inside the pharmacy behind the counter where the fax machine is. This is a ancient form of communication from back in the days. We still have it around.
Rosa works at a pharmacy in New York City that still gets faxes on paper. Pharmacies and doctor's offices have clung to the fax machine even as most consumers have left it behind.
How often does this thing go off in a given week?
As of now, it'll go off like maybe like once or twice a day.
And she says about 90% of those faxes are junk.
Sometimes I don't even look at them. I glance at them and it's garbage.
Even though fax machines are fading into obscurity, FCC data suggests that junk faxes are strangely on the rise. Last year, consumers made 40% more complaints about them than in 2022. Dr. Bruce Katz is a dermatologist in New York City. He's drowning in junk faxes.
We can get 60 or 70 faxes a day. But, you know, half of them may be junk faxes. You know, sometimes roofing companies would send us the same fax every month.
And they're not just annoying. Once, Katz had to postpone a surgery when his staff mistakenly threw out a blood test result that got lost in junk fax purgatory.
Enough is enough. I'm going to sue these companies now because they're making my life difficult. They won't stop it if you just ask them nicely. So you have to come back with a hammer.
Not an actual hammer, a lawsuit. Back in the 90s, Congress passed the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. That law gives consumers like Katz the right to sue junk faxers for $500 a page. And when you need to file a junk fax lawsuit, you probably call
Brian Wansa. I'm a principal in a law firm in the Chicago area, and I've been handling junk fax cases since 2003.
Wansa is prolific. He files class action lawsuits where legions of small businesses band together to sue one junk faxer. With enough people and faxes, that money adds up. One lawsuit settled in 2014 for $21 million. And money aside, Wansa hates junk faxes.
It's still a nuisance. It takes you away from your business, and it makes you pay for somebody else's advertising.
Still, suing junk faxers is not so straightforward. First, it might not be possible to identify who's faxing you. Or you might be getting faxes via email, where the law is a lot muddier. Or you might just be one person. And so if suing isn't an option, you can always try the John Epkins method. He used to get junk faxes at work back in the 80s. Here's how he got even. Let's say Epkins got an electronics ad. He'd tape four sheets of paper together in a loop, write,
"Do not fax us again. Take us off your mailing list, yada, yada, yada."
And then fax it back to the junk faxer. He let that run as long as he could. During the daytime, someone on the other end might see what's happening and unplug the fax machine.
But if you sent it at 3 o'clock in the morning, you knew there was no one going to be watching that machine, so they would come in the morning and find half a roll of paper on the floor.
Did it work? Did people stop sending faxes?
Yeah, absolutely. We never heard from those people again, yeah.
Katz has stopped using a physical fax machine. Now he gets faxes sent to his email. He still gets a couple junk faxes in his inbox. And this year, believe it or not, the Supreme Court will decide whether he can sue for those ones too. For NPR News, I'm Vito Emanuel.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And me, Martinez. Virginia's primary elections are today, but you won't find candidates for governor on the ballot. That race is already set. WAMU's Virginia politics reporter Margaret Barthel has a look at who is running to lead this purple state.
This community hall in Alexandria, Virginia, right across the river from D.C., is packed with Moms Demand Action volunteers in bright red T-shirts. That's former Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, the Democratic Party's nominee in the governor's race, who got her start in politics as a volunteer.
I vividly remember my first Moms Demand Action meeting. It was in a library in Henrico County, and I walked in super nervous.
Spanberger, a former CIA officer, tells the crowd she supports banning ghost guns, which she argues is pro-law enforcement.
If we are serious about stopping violent criminals, we must prevent them from manufacturing and distributing illegal, untraceable firearms.
This is all classic Spanberger, who's long cultivated a reputation as a moderate policy wonk on issues like fentanyl overdoses, veterans, and agriculture. Elected to Congress in the 2018 Blue Wave, the second Trump administration is now the backdrop for her run for governor. There are 300,000 federal employees living in Virginia, and lots of federal contractors, too. So government cuts here are personal. But Spanberger isn't relying on opposition to Trump to get her over the finish line. She's also talking about housing and affordability.
I'm standing up for Virginians in opposition to policies that are dangerous and bad for them, but also putting out a plan for what comes next.
Her Republican opponent, Lieutenant Governor Winsome Earl Sears, says Spanberger is more of a radical than she seems.
My opponent voted to have criminal, illegal aliens remain in this country.
She's referring to a vote opposing detentions for immigrants arrested for burglary and theft. Earl Sears is a Jamaican immigrant, a Marine veteran, and a former small business owner who could become the nation's first Black woman governor. She's running as the natural successor of her boss, current Governor Glenn Youngkin. Virginia law only allows governors one term at a time.
Sorry for the traffic. Take it up with the governor.
At a volunteer event, Earl Sears says she'll continue Youngkin's focus on business development and lower taxes.
You might know that as we talk about freedom, well, freedom also means you keeping as much money that you make in your own pocket.
She says she empathizes with people losing their jobs, but supports federal cuts.
So there has been waste, there's been fraud, and there's been abuse, and the American people, even Democrats, I'm hearing from them, have said, our money has been going to what?
And she says Virginia's economy is ready to absorb some of those workers after 4 years of Republican leadership. Earl Sears also has a culturally conservative streak. She's against abortion rights and last year wrote that she was morally opposed to a marriage equality measure in the state legislature. The race has J. Miles Coleman with the University of Virginia Center for Politics thinking back to 4 years ago. Democrat Terry McAuliffe focused heavily on Trump and then lost to Youngkin, the first Republican to win statewide office in years.
Obviously, even in 2021, Donald Trump was not popular in Virginia, but I think Terry McAuliffe seemed to overplay that card.
Coleman says if Spanberger wins, it might help Democrats redefine their party identity beyond opposition to Trump.
This would be, you know, more of a concrete win that they could point to.
An Earl Sears win, meanwhile, could give Republicans their own midterms playbook. Either way, Virginia is on track to elect its first woman governor. For NPR News in Arlington, Virginia, I'm Margaret Barthel.
I bet that you will be amused by this next story.
Pay the man, Steve, because yes, you're right, I will be abused. It's about a bet on the National Hockey League's Stanley Cup Finals. The Florida Panthers are one win away from becoming back-to-back champs.
Edmonton Oilers fans are still holding out hope they can come back. And one of those fans is Edmonton's mayor, Amarjeet Sohi. He's hoping for a different result than last year when the Oilers lost the final series and he lost a bet.
Unfortunately, I had to wear the Florida Panthers jersey last year and had to go into City Hall meeting wearing it.
Edmonton's mayor made that bet with Mike Ryan, the mayor of Sunrise, Florida, which is where the Panthers play. And when the final became a rematch this year, Ryan agreed to another bet with higher stakes.
What we're doing this year is when the Florida Panthers win, we're going to send him a proclamation for him to read declaring City of Sunrise, Florida, and the Florida Panthers Day in Edmonton, and he has to read it just like we wrote it.
Okay, mayoral bets are a tradition that has been going on since at least the 1930s. In the 1938 World Series, the New York Yankees defeated the Chicago Cubs, of course, and New York Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia won a 500-pound pig.
What?
I guess, you know, Chicago slaughterhouses, commodity markets, pork bellies. So he got a pig from Chicago.
Yeah, makes sense. In 2011, Pittsburgh Mayor Luke Ravenstahl had to hang a Packers flag on the city county building after the Steelers lost the Super Bowl to the Green Bay Packers. And he spoke to WTAE that day while wearing a Packer shirt.
Take it down now, right?
Yeah.
They won't know the difference. It was up all day, we swear.
Now in Sunrise, Florida, Mayor Ryan says these traditions have a bigger meaning.
It's about the connection of two cities or a connection of countries, talking about why they enjoy so much the benefits of sports, not just for the economy, but what it does for a community.
Connection, blah, blah, blah. It's about winning. It's about winning. No, 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 no. It's about connection. And in Edmonton, Mayor Sohi values the effect it has on his city.
As mayors, we have a responsibility to kind of continue to instill and support that pride in our players and in our community. So that's the reason that this tradition has carried on for decades.
Sunrise Mayor Ryan hopes he'll avoid embarrassment of acknowledging the Oilers' greatness, but he'll still wait on the final score.
We learned last year that when we were up 3-0 and people were talking about the parade in South Florida, we then went on to lose 3 games.
The Panthers can win the Cup tonight if they beat the Oilers in Florida. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez.